whole corner is about to be turned in the history of Israel. 2 Samuel chapter 3 records the story of the final stage of David's rise to power as the first king of a fully united Israel. Last week we saw that Abner, the military commander of the real power behind the throne of Ish-bosheth, who was Saul's son, used a somewhat contrived crisis to make a move to depose Ish-bosheth and turn the northern kingdom over to David. And the crisis was that Abner went into Ish-bosheth's harem, the harem that he had inherited from his father, Saul, and he had sexual relations with Rizpah, perhaps the most prominent woman in the harem. And in this era, such a thing was done to show total disrespect for the current leadership and to indicate that a new leader had arisen to usurp the old one. In other words, there is no doubt that Abner created an excuse to have a confrontation with Ish-bosheth by means of his cavorting with Rizpah, so that he could do just what he did: transfer Saul's old kingdom from Ish-bosheth to David. Now, there were several motivations for Abner to do such a thing, even though the one he spoke about actually seemed to be righteous in nature. Abner says that the reason that he is going to hand the kingdom over to David is because God had made it publicly known that David was to be king over all Israel, and therefore Abner was merely acting in obedience to this divine decree. But behind this supposed pious purpose was a personal agenda. There were some political realities as well. And for one, we read in verse 17 of 2 Samuel chapter 3 that many of the elders of the northern tribes had groused for some time that they preferred David over Ish-bosheth. And Ish-bosheth was a weak king. He was somewhat of an embarrassment, and the people liked what they saw in David. Thus, as we discussed last week, in tribal societies, the ongoing game is to position yourself, your clan, your tribe, to be in the good graces of the current leader, but you're always on the lookout for a new and stronger leader to ally yourself with for your tribe's benefit. Now, it had become obvious by now that David was that new, stronger leader, and the northern tribes merely needed a proper shove to move their loyalties over to him. And Abner was in a similar position. He was the leader of the military of the north, and he knew that soon David would overcome them and he would become king of all Israel. It was customary that the top military commander was the second command to the king. But David already had a military commander in good standing in Joab, David's nephew. So, if the kingdom fell to David, guess who was out of a job? Abner. On the other hand, if it was Abner who approached David with a gracious offer to bloodlessly deliver the scepter of power over to him, just maybe Abner could negotiate a position as second in power in David's administration and kind of outmaneuver Joab, his nephew. So Abner met with the northern tribal leaders, and he told them that he wanted them to agree to make David their king. And then next, he went to the leaders of the tribe of Benjamin, who weren't nearly as anxious for a change, because it would mean the throne that had been held by a Benjamite would now be turned over to somebody from the tribe of Judah. All realized, whether they fully agreed or not, if Abner was for it, who was going to be against it? So Abner paid David a state visit with a distinguished entourage of 20 tribal elders. A proper feast was held to commemorate the event and to show respect, and it was agreed that these northern tribes would now give their loyalty to that southern David. All that was left was for a general assembly of all the northern tribal coalition leaders to convene and now formally confirm David. So David bid his new ally Abner farewell and guaranteed him a safe journey back north to his home territory. So let's begin from there at 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 22. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 337. 2 Samuel chapter 3, beginning at verse 22. Just then, David's men and Joab returned from a raid, bringing a lot of plunder with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron because he had sent him off under safe conduct. And when Joab and all of his army had arrived, Joab was told, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, but he sent him off and he's left under safe conduct. And Joab went to the king and said, what have you done? Here, Abner came to you and you sent him away and now he's gone. Why? You know Abner, the son of Ner. He came only to deceive you, to learn what campaigns you're planning, to find out everything you're doing. And after leaving David, Joab sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the water cistern at Sirah without David's knowledge. And upon Abner's return to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the space between the inner and the outer city gates as if to speak with him privately, and there struck him in the groin so that he died, thus avenging the death of Asahel, his brother. And afterwards, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever innocent of the death of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it fall on the head of Joab and all of his father's family. May Joab's family always have someone with a hemorrhage or a zarat, or who has to walk with a cane, or who dies by the sword, or who lacks food. Thus Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner, because he had killed their brother, Asahel, during the battle. But David said to Joab and all those with him, tear your clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourn over Abner. King David himself walked behind the body as was carried, and they buried Abner at Hebron. And the king wept aloud at Abner's grave, and all the people wept. And the king sang this lament over Abner. Should Abner have died like a thug? Your hands weren't tied, your feet weren't fettered. You fell like one who falls at the hands of a criminals. And all the people wept over him more than ever. And all the people came to David, tried to make him eat some bread while it was still daytime. But David swore, may God do bring terrible curses down on me, worse ones yet, if I taste bread or anything else until the sun goes down. And all the people took note of this, and it pleased them. Whatever the king did pleased all the people. So that day, all the people, all Israel understood that the king had had no part in the killing of Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, you realize that a great leader, a great man has fallen today in Israel. Even though I have just been anointed king, I feel weak today. These men, these sons of Zeruah, are too brutal for me. May Adonai repay the criminal as his crime deserves. It's no coincidence that Abner came to David while Joab was away, leading a raiding party. No doubt, when Abner sent messengers asking for a meeting, the cunning David knew that with Joab present, there wasn't going to be any real chance for a treaty, and Abner likely wouldn't even survive the meeting. Recall that Joab was now in a blood feud with Abner because he had killed Joab's brother, Asahel. So David arranged for Joab to be gone. And when Joab returned and he heard about Abner's visit, he became furious and he confronted King David. And verse 22 makes a point that Joab returned with a rav shalal, meaning a huge abundance, a great amount of captured plunder. So Joab was feeling pretty proud of himself, no doubt, brimming with confidence. And then he finds out that behind his back, this meeting with his mortal enemy had taken place. And one must look at the tone of Yoav's words and notice somewhat of a parallel with the way that Abner spoke to Ishbosheth. And just as Abner was so incensed, although again I think he was kind of embellishing a little bit, just kind of enhances this crisis that he created, and he felt free to openly speak his mind to the king, so we see Joab being surprisingly strong, freely expressing his indignation with his words towards King David. And on the surface, it seems as though Joab is sincerely concerned that Abner came merely to discover David's military plans, and David had played the dupe to Abner's cleverness. But in fact, although the English hides it, there's kind of a sarcastic and even an offensive sexual undertone in Joab's remarks. And although women, you may not always be aware of it, men often insult one another by saying that they're behaving as females or serving as a female in a sex act. And as unsavory as all that is, it's hardly a modern phenomenon. It goes all the way back probably to the second or third generation of humans. Verses 24 and 25 have you up complaining to David that Abner came to you. He came only to deceive you. Actually, what it says most literally is that Abner went into you because he came to seduce you. The words used are nearly identical. They're meant to be taken in exactly the same sense as when Ishbosheth accused Abner of seducing and having sex with Rizpah, Saul's concubine. I don't think I need to draw this picture with much more detail, but that's the reference here. The point is that Joab was really brazen in his insult to King David. And David's amazingly silent because there's no record of David responding like you might think he would to this kind of blatant insubordination, even though it's his own family. But one must also understand what was going through Joab's mind and the stakes that were involved here. Because he too understood that if these two kingdoms, the north and the south, combined under one king, there would not be room for two top military commanders. There can't be two seconds in command. So he instantly suspected, and rightly so, that Abner was there to negotiate his way into Joab's position, and since David had deceived Joab to send him away for Abner to come safely, naturally thought that his worst suspicions were about to come about. Well, this firm conviction had a lot to do with what comes next. Joab was not going to go down without a fight. He wasn't David's top military commander because he could be easily run over by a competitor. Joab sent some messengers, his men, after Abner, apparently lying to him, telling him that David needed to come back. And Abner had traveled only a few miles up the road leading north from their meeting at Hebron when the messengers came upon him at a place called the Cistern at Sirah. And when Abner arrived back at Hebron, expecting that all was well, Joab greeted him. And he drew him aside to a place between the inner and the outer gates of the city, a place where they could have a moment of privacy. Not suspecting anything, this great warrior Abner was at ease. Joab struck. Joab killed two birds with one stone, part of the fight. By slaying Abner, he not only did away with his rival for his job as David's number two man, but he also did his duty in his eyes as the family's Goel Hadon, family's blood avenger. Joab avenged his brother Asahel's death at Abner's hands. Now there is some symbolism here about Joab killing Abner at the city gate. First is that by stabbing Abner near the fifth rib, He pierced Abner in the same place that Abner pierced Asahel. And second, the city gate was the customary place in the Middle East where court was convened and where decisions were handed down by the elders. So the idea is that the city gate is the place where justice is handed out. To Joab, he was bringing Abner to justice at the place of justice, the city gates. But was justice really being served? I say no. This was not justice. It was just pure revenge. It was wrong. Now, this is one of those many cases I suggested you watch for as we proceed through Samuel, 2 Samuel, because the Torah law, see, was being twisted, being turned, it was kind of being degraded and molded to fit comfortable and long-held Middle Eastern customs of all kinds. Just as do Christians today. Israelites had little trouble rationalizing their actions that were so normal for ancient societies of every kind by painting a face of piety on nothing more than a worldly pagan behavior and attitude by adding some Hebrew religion to it. Somehow by assigning a biblical name or misapplying a scriptural passage taken out of context, a wrongful behavior was made not only right, but maybe even good and pleasing to God. See, the Torah law is very clear that death in battle is justifiable killing, and it is certainly not murder. There is no criminality to it. There's not even any atonement necessary for it, and it was not what the laws concerning the blood avenger and the sanctuary cities were established to deal with. Sanctuary cities were meant to deal with what today we would probably call manslaughter. Matters of accidental or unintended or maybe perhaps negligent homicide. And just as sanctuary cities were not for the purpose of protecting murderers who lay in wait for their victims, neither were they for protecting warriors who had killed an enemy in the heat of battle. And this is because warriors who killed in the heat of battle did nothing wrong. They needed no protection. Thus, when in battle, Asahel chased down Abner with the intention to kill him, and Abner pled with Asahel to turn away because Asahel was certain he was going to die, he wouldn't listen. He wouldn't listen to reason. Thus, in battle, self-defense really, Abner killed Asahel. That Joab, Asahel's anguished brother, deemed this an unlawful death, an unjustifiable death, worthy of a legally sanctioned revenge, and that Abner was now, to Joab's way of thinking, the equivalent of a person who needed to escape to a sanctuary city, this is completely wrong-minded. This is a total perversion of the Torah law, the law of Moses. See, it isn't that hard to see this if we know the Torah when we're reading these stories. Pretty apparent. What's harder to see, however, is how we do such similar things in our own everyday lives. We at times twist and turn the Bible to allow us to have our way and to not appear all that different at the same time from our neighbors. We discuss among ourselves as Christian brothers and sisters about how our eyes are the portal to our minds and that we need to guard them against unclean things, and then we go see the same Hollywood filth at the movies that we claim is bad and that our neighbors do. We say that we're firm believers in a literal Bible, then claim that we can abolish God's appointed times, or we can declare Shabbat any day of the week we choose, whatever is convenient for us, as long as we celebrate it generally every 7 days or so. What do you suppose Christ would say about any of our personal customized Sabbath days and holiday choices that generally dispose of the ones his father ordained? How about our modern infatuation with accumulating personal wealth? that fits nicely with an all too commonly taught doctrine that God once intends for us all to be rich in material possessions. And we will be if we just believe that with enough conviction. See, we certainly don't see ourselves as unfaithful worshipers remaking God's laws in our image any more than did Joab. Cultural customs, cherished symbols, those are powerful things, as are doctrines and traditions and peer pressure. But as the Lord's followers, we're supposed to resist these man-made things when they don't agree with God's word. Not make excuses, not rationalize them and embrace them, but that's a lot easier said than done, isn't it? Being a leader in any age is a tough deal. One must balance what must be done with what can be done. And David has shown the utmost restraint in dealing with Saul. And now, since Saul's death, in dealing with Ishbosheth, allowing events to occur naturally under the divinely ordered course, we see his devotedness to the Lord. But we also see that because of his own character and principles, because there were political realities that had to be considered, we see another side of David. So when David learned of Abner's death at Joab's treacherous hand, all sorts of thoughts flooded through his mind, just what this was going to mean for him. And of course, his first thought was, those northern tribes, oh man, they were going to view Abner's death as David's responsibility, not his doing. It was the beginning it would be in their eyes the beginning of cleaning the house of any potential threats or competitors in preparation to assume the throne of all Israel. So immediately he declares his innocence of Abner's death, and that whatever consequences, divine or fleshly, that was due for this murderous act ought to fall upon Joab and all of his father's family. And David then proceeds to issue a kind of a curse, standard Middle Eastern way of speaking, upon Joab's family. It includes that someone in it ought to always be suffering from a discharge called zuv, or from leprosy. It's not really leprosy. All right, but Sarat, or would need to walk with a cane. In other words, they would have a limp. They would be gimpy. All right, or somebody who's killed in battle, somebody who doesn't have enough lechem, bread, food. Now let me remind you that the first two sufferings, zuv and sarat, are seen as spiritually, not naturally, caused affliction. And that, again, Sarat's not leprosy. It's indicative of this whole range of nasty and debilitating skin diseases and severe rashes. And like any public politician, David was quickly distancing himself from the actions of someone in his administration who had done something that could be pretty damaging to him. Now, did David benefit from this in some way? Yeah, perhaps. It certainly further weakened the northern kingdom to lose its legendary military command. But it could also only cause more difficulty for David, probably, than it created advantage. How could the northern tribe not be suspicious of Abner's death at Hebron, David's headquarters, despite David's protest? He had nothing to do with it. And it was true. Well, verse 30 says, in the complete Jewish Bible, thus, Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel during the battle in Gibeon. Now, this was not put here so as to repeat the facts for future readers. Unfortunately, most English translations miss the point of this passage, which is that a contrast is being presented to clearly differentiate between the nature of these two killings. That killing of Asahel versus now the killing of Abner. The word describing Abner's death is harad. and it carries the sense of murder or destruction, unjustifiable homicide. The word used to describe Azazel's death is mut, and it leans towards meaning to die as a cause of execution, some kind of justifiable killing. In fact, the narrator makes it clear that Azazel's death occurred in battle, while Joab and Abishai merely slew Abner in a totally non-combat situation. Well, essentially now, from here to the end of chapter 3, David is doing damage control. He's making quite a show of all of his sorrow and repugnance in order to distance himself from this dirty deed, murdering Abner. And no doubt, he was being as sincere as he was pragmatic. He was doing all the things that the Middle Eastern and the Hebrew culture would instantly understand that only a sincere man could do. He mourned, and he ordered that everybody else was to mourn. He spoke a proper and respectful eulogy over Abner. He threw an elegant and all-encompassing curse over Abner's killers, even though those killers were his own sister's sons. And he even walked behind Abner's body in a funeral procession, which is the highest honor that a king could ever confer upon the deceased, and actually, it was usually reserved only for a royal family member. But as we're going to find out later, for instance, in chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, not everyone in Israel believed David's story. They weren't convinced of his innocence in this matter. Chapter 16, we're going to read of the story of a man named Shimei. He was a distant relative of Saul, who was a Benjamite. And how he curses King David, and he throws rocks at the king and his men, and then he openly blames them for the deaths of Saul and Ishbosheth. But for the most part, however, verses 35 and 36 of chapter 3 make it clear that the people did believe David, and they were satisfied that he'd gone out of his way to show the greatest respect to this great warrior, Abner, who had been such a worthy adversary for all these years. Even so, David was in a political bind. The last couple of verses show that despite being king of Judah, he had by no means consolidated his power. He knew he needed to punish Joab for committing this murder from the viewpoints of God's Torah's justice, and to show the north that he was a just and fair man, not partial. But these violent sons of David's sister, Seruah, and apparently the family's position in society, well, it just didn't allow for that to happen right this moment. So David said to his servants, meaning those in the king's court, throughout court, that even though he is the anointed king, he feels weak. That is, he's just not in a position, a political position, to force his will on this matter at this moment in time. Thus, David asks the Lord, asks Yahweh, to take justice upon these criminals. Let's move on to 2 Samuel chapter 4. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 330. Page 338, 2 Samuel chapter 4. When Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, his courage failed. All Israel became alarmed. Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding parties, one called Baana and the other Rechab, sons of Ramon the Beeroti, of the people of Benjamin, for Beirut is counted as part of Benjamin, even though the Beerotim fled to Gittayim and have lived as foreigners there to this day. Now Yehonatan, Jonathan, the son of Shaul, had a son, and he was lame in both legs. And he had been 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse had gathered him up and fled, but as she was hurrying to get away, he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. And the sons of Ramon, the Beeroti, Rechab and Baana, went and arrived during the heat of the day at the home of Ishbosheth as he was taking his afternoon rest. And they went right into the house as if they were coming to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the groin. and the Rechab and Baanah's brother escaped. They entered the house as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, stabbed him and killed him. Then they beheaded him. And they took his head and fled all night along the road through the Arabah. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David in Hebron and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy, who wanted to take your life. Today Adonai has taken revenge on Saul and for his son for the sake of my lord the king." But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, the sons of Ramon, the Beirotim, "As Adonai lives, who has rescued me from every kind of difficulty, when someone told me, 'Here, Saul is dead,' thinking to himself that he was bringing good news, I didn't reward him for his news, but I seized him and killed him in Ziklag. But how much more, when criminals have killed an innocent man in his own house, on his own bed, shouldn't I hold you responsible for his death and rid the earth of you?" David then gave the order to his men, and they put them to death, cutting off their hands and feet and hanging them next to the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and they buried in Abner's grave at Hebron. Well, the scene now moves to Mahanaim, north of where David is in the Transjordan, where Ishbosheth is ruling. And we should understand that what we just read, what I just read, is occurring at the same time as the final events of chapter 3. That is, while the funeral's going on, then afterwards David is lamenting his predicament, Ishbosheth and the people of the north have received word of Abner's murder, and they are reacting in shock to it. News travels fast. It does in those days too. It's unimaginable that any more than a day passed before the story of Abner's demise had reached the citizens north of Judah. And verse 1 explains that all Israel became alarmed over this. And this, of course, is referring to the northern tribal coalition. And the people of the north feared that Abner's death was merely the opening volley of David taking revenge for all those years that they had fought against him. Ishbosheth also must have had mixed feelings, because the man who was in process of taking his kingdom from him, he was now dead. However, the same man controlled the military, and he'd been the de facto power of the north that had held that coalition of tribes together. Obviously, Ishbosheth had neither the regal bearing to rule, nor did he have the diplomatic skills to maneuver through this minefield of clans and tribes and foreign nations, but that was something that Abner was very adept at. Ishbosheth knew that when it was all added up, he was in worse shape without Abner than he was with him. With Abner, he would probably remain alive and be decently treated. But without Abner, different story. So now that we know that the scene has shifted up to the northern headquarters, a new element's at two scoundrels named Baanah and Rechab are introduced to us. Their father is a fellow named Rimmon, who is said to come from Beirut. And then to help explain the relationship with Ishbosheth, some tribal and some family history is here. Well, Beirut was one of several named villages and towns that fell to the tribe of Benjamin. In Joshua 18:21-28, we get the listing of cities and towns reckoned to Benjamin by Joshua. It says there, the cities of the tribe of the descendants of Benjamin according to their families were Jericho, Beit Hoglah, Amek Gezitz, Beit Arabah, Samaraim, Beitel, Avim, Harah, Ophrah, Kfar Amonah, Ophni and Geba, 12 cities together with their villages, Gibeon, Ramah, and Beirut. And the list continues. But notice, the last name I mentioned was Beirut. And it seems that some number of this city's population had fled to Gittaim, up near Beth Peron, just a few miles northwest from Beirut. So likely this was a village that had now become almost abandoned. It had become virtually a ghost town. And Rashi says that the flight of this mixed race city occurred at the time of 1 Samuel 31, when the Philistines attacked the northern tribes and killed Saul. I say mixed race because this was a village of Gentiles, of course, at the time that Joshua and Israel arrived, but it had now been taken over and controlled by the tribe of Benjamin. And apparently this village, as did so many, assimilated into the Israelite tribe that occupied the land. And recall that we are at a time in 2 Samuel that is at least 3 centuries since Joshua crossed over the Jordan. So there had been a whole lot of mixing going on between the Gentiles of Canaan and the 12 tribes of Israel. So by now, the people of Beirut were considered as members of the tribe of Benjamin, even though many of them, whose real heritage were simply as Gentile Canaanites, were but a memory. That's the case we're seeing. Now likely, 2,500 years ago and more, the situation about Beirut was understood by the Israelites living in the land. So this detail that was provided for us is a very important one. What happens regarding these guys makes their heritage and their tribal affiliation important. And verse 4 now adds more information. It's important to help us understand the sense of tragedy was just on the horizon. David's dearest friend, Jonathan, had a son named Mephibosheth. And when the nurse who was in charge of Mephibosheth's care got the horrifying news that Saul and his son Jonathan were killed in battle, and that the Philistines were overrunning the land, she snatched up that 5-year-old child and in a panic began to flee. But she dropped. He became permanently crippled as a result. Almost certainly a spinal injury of some kind had occurred. And Mephibosheth, you see, was Saul's grandson. But his mother was Rizpah. Yep, that Rizpah of Saul and Ishbosheth's harem, that woman that Abner had slept. Now, there is some disagreement on Rizpah as his mother, but most of the ancient rabbis say he was. There is biblical evidence of it, and it helps make sense out of why Rizpah was so prominent in this overall story, and even in some later ones. Now, notice how similar are the names Mephibosheth and Ishbosheth. We discussed how later Hebrew editors tended to replace the word Baal with the word Bosheth, as they found using the term Baal was just too offensive to write. Now, I'm not going to explain all the nuances of Baal and Ishbosheth today. We'll go back to the previous lesson and review that. But it is thought that Mephibosheth means something like exterminate Baal or cut down the idol of Baal. In any case, as a son of Jonathan, there's no doubt that it's meant to denote a good and righteous, strong name. Later on, in yet another variation of his name is going to be found in 1 Chronicles 8 and 9, and it's Meriv Baal. Meriv Baal. See, here's the thing. The reason for the insertion of this information about Mephibosheth is to help explain the supreme sadness of Ishbosheth's coming death. There is no heir to Saul's throne once Ishbosheth is dead. Mephibosheth is more or less the last person who even has a close enough family tie to Saul to at least qualify to be part of his royal dynasty. But there's no way that a man lame from childhood can be made king. So the end of Saul's house is almost here. Ish-bosheth's coming demise signals the death blow to the entire house of Saul. And in tribal society, that is the greatest tragedy. So now that we have the needed background on the players in this story, verse 7 begins to explain that the two sons of Rimmon went to the house where Ish-bosheth lived when he was taking an afternoon siesta. And they appeared to be coming, they said, to get some wheat. And they were probably quite familiar to most of the servants and the guards, and as we were told earlier, that they were the captains, actually, of some of Ish-bosheth's raiding parties. And as Ish-bosheth lay sleeping, taking a nap, they assassinated him. Then they beheaded him, and they brought his head to King David. Now, their motive for doing this is explained in verse 8. Knowing that Abner was dead, knowing that Ish-bosheth had no hope of ruling, these two men wanted to attract David's favor by eliminating his rival for the throne. Thus, by this means, they felt they were demonstrating their loyalty to this new king, David. So they expected a high reward, consisting of high positions in David's administration. But even if they were right in their claim that Saul had deserved to die because of his irrational pursuit all those years of David, what had Ish-bosheth done to deserve this kind of treatment? Wise man long ago told me something to always keep in mind. People tend to automatically assume that others have the same mindset and character flaws that they have. They assumed that since they would have been threatened, if someone had done for them what they had done for David, that David would applaud this treacherous and vile act. But far from rewarding them, David gave them their just rewards as murderers. He had them immediately executed. That Amalekite who had killed Saul at least did so at Saul's behest, but it was still murder of God's anointed. No court was necessary for Baanah and Rechab. They confessed it. They were boastful about it. They murdered a king as he slept, a fellow member of the tribe of Benjamin they killed for crass gain. The law requires the life of murderers. And what David did here then was completely lawful. Yet, we end this chapter with but another reminder of how the Torah law, the law of Moses, had become corrupt by intermingling it with man-made Middle Eastern traditions and customs. It was right for David to execute those two murderers, but mutilation even of a corpse is not okay. Then he cut off their hands and feet is not permitted by the law. But it was customary, remember. It was meant to be symbolic. See, they used their feet to run to commit murder, and they used their hands to commit that dastardly deed. So he had them cut off. We'll start chapter 5 next.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.